That's a Knisper Sacrament or my herbal. As once you get that adrenaline level, it's really an easy night.
I think my best night was my first night. And then after sides, it could work.
U meta nara din l-imħabba ngħidu hekk u din l-enerġija kollha tan-nisfi flimkien naħseb il-karriera tiegħi tissodisfani ħafna b'dan rispett.
Din l-varjetà hija importanti ħafna. Għot il-varjetà għat-turisti li għabu ħat ħajħedha. Mbaka tamel l-istess ħagħad bulħat, noħsin nis mux ħajdurek.
I think it's been very successful. Kajjer, konna dija monesti, għad-dibna ħabta nis.
I mean, who wouldn't choose a lifestyle of being paid to play music, of having a free bar tariff and being paid to make people have fun and being part of that fun yourself? I mean, who wouldn't want a job like that?
Kikum ma kienu jizmin zbieħ, grandiuzi, gloriuzi. Kullum maħnix bil-qeda unek edin nitkelmu. Fuq il-passat tagħna.
Campus FM jippreżenta għalfejn il-lejla? Ħars allura lejn l-era ta' twelid u tkattir ta' diskoteki f'pajjiżna, kif ukoll ta' Paċeville bħala l-kapitali ta' xena ta' divertiment ta' bil-lejl. Produzzjoni u preżentazzjoni tiegħi Colin Fitz.
Episodju numru 11 ta' għalfejn il-lejla fuq 103.7 Campus FM jiena Colin Fitz. Il-lum se nkompli id-diskursata ma' Ian James li kien ġie Malta fil-bidu ta' snin 80 biex jaħdem bħala DJ u tekniku fl-Stones Discotheque ta' Buġibba. Kien ukoll jaħdem fl-diskoteki fostom Styx, Styx 2, anka fil-Palladium li kien fetaħ fil-bidu ta' snin design u eventualment fil-Euphoria li kienet żvilupp ta' diskoteka Styx u Styx 2 u anka bħala amministratur fid-diskoteka Access sa' snin 2000. Ian James ikompli jaqsam il-memorji tiegħu mill-qasam tad-divertiment ta' bil-lejl ta' Malta ta' snin 80 u design. Jgħidilna dwar il-foam parties tal-Stones, DJs Maltin li rom jibdew il-karriera tagħhom u anka dwar l-element negattiv li jeżisti f'dan il-qasam f'kull pajjiż.
So you mentioned the small criminal element, which everybody that I spoke to mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Would you give us a few words about that? Did you see any trouble? Did you ever feel uncomfortable? Did you ever have to deal with some situation?
Well, obviously, I mean, I was given the time I was here and so on. You had the Fusellos and so on, and the Shadines and all the rest. Everybody that had a nickname, you stayed away from. If somebody came, he's a bully, or he's this, or he's ill that. Okay, don't want to know. I'll speak with David, John, Franz, whatever, but I won't speak to anybody that's got some clever nickname, because 9 times out of 10 it brings trouble with it.
Did you ever witness anything that you thought action would be taken about it and then it wasn't, because these people had power or whatever, you know? Or
well, there's always that sort of thing going on. It was always who you knew that got anything done, whether it was criminality or lots of other things. But at the end of the day, as you well know, I mean, I was there at Bar Bamboo for the shootings. I was in a few other places where things happened. So I saw criminality and lawlessness at first hand. But it was not the norm. You knew who the bad guys were, you stayed away from them, or you did what was necessary to keep them away from you. You just didn't get yourself involved. At the end of the day, I was still a foreigner. I remember, now everybody jokes about the go back to your country sort of situation. I didn't feel that ever when I was in Malta. I was always made to feel very welcome. I don't know where this has all come from nowadays. Maybe because there are a lot more foreigners living in Malta now, that perhaps criticise certain things that are Maltese. But at the time I was here, I didn't find things to criticise. I got on with life, I got on with everybody. And nobody gave me any of that go back to your own country nonsense.
As regards, as you said, nightlife, there's going to be an element of criminality somewhere and gangsters, tough guys, whatever.
Mm.
Was Malta different from other countries though, or did other countries have their own version of that sort of
every
thing?
Every country
was
has
Malta
its own.
Unique?
Every country has its own version. You want me to give you instances? Okay, London. Working at La Valbonne. We used to go across the road after we finished La Valbonne to a club called Candy Box.
which was run by some of the toughest criminals in town. It was an ex place that used to belong to the Krays and so on in the old days. And being in there one night, and you had a very heavy steel door to get in there with a small speakeasy window. When you used to want to go in, you had to bang on the door, small window would open. They either knew you, didn't know you, or you had the right thing. Exactly that. A bouncer looked in through the window one day and met a 12-bore shotgun coming the other way, took his head off. And we all ended up being locked inside while the police came and interviewed all of us.
Sounds like Al Capone
here. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, they were tough. They were tough people. There were things happened. I mean, when I worked in L.A., the guy that I worked with there, I mean, I remember going home in his car one time. In those days, in California, you were allowed to have so many small spliffs of marijuana for your own personal consumption. It wasn't considered illegal in that time. And driving home a day, and he had a lovely Mercedes, the Gullwing Sports, and he asked me if I could pass him a spliff from the glove box. Okay, so I opened it up for him. As it fell down, there's two guns crisscrossed, clamped on the back of it, and I'm like, whoa! Because these were cannons, you know? And he said, you think that's anything? Lift the dickie at the back. And I lift the dickie, reach back behind the seat, lift the small dickie piece up. Inside there, he had three more shotguns. He said, they tried to rob me one night when I was coming out of the club. Next time, it's war. And I'm thinking, this is a guy who, this is a small guy. That you wouldn't think, a bit like a Scarface situation, you know? I'm the bad guy, but I'm the smallest guy in the room.
Okay.
You know, these things are all around you, all the time. But you can't get involved.
Right, so the 80s are coming along. At first you'd open every night at Stones. Eventually it went back to the original plan of only opening on the weekends. Did Stones start to decline?
Well, not really. I mean, the situation was that Stones started to decline when we opened Sticks 2. Because Stones wasn't so necessary anymore.
So, and what year was that, around the mid-80s?
Yeah, late 80s, isn't it? 86, 87, something like that.
I think it was before, when Axis opened, which was 88, Sticks 2 existed.
Mm-hmm.
So it must have been 86?
Yeah, about 86. But as I said, I mean, the whole thing about it was that when we opened the new Sticks, the Sticks 2, I mean, it was so big that Stones became almost irrelevant, because what had happened before, where Stones had sucked everything from the island towards it when it first opened, the new Sticks sucked everything in its direction.
Did you see any other clubs being rivals, Dewdrops, Raffles, until Axis opened? Because apparently Axis then changed the game quite a lot. But I don't know your impression.
It didn't. Because, I mean, everybody, I think, had their own crowd as a mainstay. I mean, some people say, well, you won't catch me dead in that place, or I wouldn't go there because, or whatever. And so you had your own main group, and then you just found ways to build around it. I mean, that was the times when we suddenly needed to have promoters, we needed to do promotions, we needed to bring in different sponsors and so on to build the places up. I mean, don't forget, I mean, Stones, as a success story, always worked. Totally self-contained. Yes, we got sponsors for things, but we didn't need the sponsors to operate, or we didn't need a group of promoters to go out and hand out tickets and things to make sure people came. People came. But then, as you say, when you have something the size of 6-2, and then you get Axis and everything else, all fighting for, by degree, the same people, although the Axis crowd say, oh no, we wouldn't go, we don't go to Sticks, we only go to Axis. And then, yeah, the ones that used to come into Sticks and sort of say, yeah, you know, what's his name up there, he wouldn't let us in because we've got jeans on, or whatever, or we didn't want to take our earring out. So we got that thing where Axis was considered to be slightly snobbish.
Snobbish, elitist.
And, yeah, and Sticks was somewhere everybody could come to. And then, of course, we had the big thing that when we built the Palladium, we could run two venues at the same time in a discotheque format. I mean, it was enormous. I mean, people, it was like ants watching them move between the two. And you had thousands of people all in your own area just moving for the whole night.
Back to Stones, the beach parties apparently legendary. Mm. Tell us a little bit about the excesses you saw or you instigated yourself over there.
Well, we wanted something that was going to make something different in midweek. And originally we started them, if I remember right, we started them on Wednesdays. Which was just to give it a little G up, and it was something as well that for the summer was another impetus to bring all the young British in, because it was something Ibiza-ish that was happening in Malta, you know, and we could promote it as such. And obviously the whole thing was, when you got there, you were expected to be the girls in bikini tops, and the guys could come, you know, could take their shirts off or just wear tank tops or whatever, and shorts for the night. And it was not so much an anything goes, but a total party atmosphere. I mean, we used to go down and savage all the local bamboo bushes everywhere, and make palm trees all over the place. And obviously them sponsors wanted to come on board. And
foam, and would you have like foam machines?
Yeah, well, we had the fog machines, and then we got the foam machines for the foam parties, which nobody had seen here in Malta. I mean, yes, you saw it at that time, big ones in Ibiza and so on, but nobody had seen one in Malta. But Stones had a small enough dance floor that literally you could run the foam machine for like about 10 minutes, and it filled it 2 feet deep, and everybody loved it. And also that amphitheater structure of the way Stones was actually built, that everybody was all the way around on all four sides, coming down into tiers to a dance floor on the bottom. It made a perfect, almost like a pool effect, so that anything you wanted to do games wise or whatever, you could just get out there on that dance floor and do it, and everybody could see, and yeah, everybody felt part of it.
Meanwhile, where are you seeing Maltese DJs, up-and-coming Maltese DJs that you worked with, that maybe you can remember from the 80s and eventually into the 90s? Mention a few.
Well, there were a few. Let's have a look. I mean, there was a little guy down in Zira called Chicho. Everybody used to call him Chicho. And he was so determined to be a DJ that he contacted me, and he actually built a DJ rig in his house there in Zira and wanted me to come down and teach him how to DJ. So we then started, I started like a small school with him, and there was David, what was David, I can't remember some of the surnames now, so long back. But there were quite a few that I used to meet them there in Zira.
Zira in their house, you mean, or was it a club?
At Chicho's father's house, you know, down there's the Zira Lions where they played snooker, and his house was virtually opposite. And it was a typical little Gazira house. You sort of went in, there was a room, and then there was a kitchen, and then upstairs a couple of bedrooms. But that front room was a disco for the day, and we used to just open the doors and blast all the music out.
Oh, so Chicho learnt his skills from you? Because he keeps coming up, all the Albert mentioned Chicho, and a lot of people mentioned.
Because the kid was really keen to learn, and he was a nice guy. Yeah, you know, so it just made fun to sort of bring on a few people. And yes, obviously, when you're playing, and like at the 6-2 situation where you had the decks where people could literally be right in on top of you and watch everything that you're doing, because it was all glass across the side, and you're working that way and facing the audience off the stage. You know, a lot of people got interested in being DJs, and a lot of people, there are a lot of good Maltese DJs from that era that started just literally by watching and learning, because they couldn't get their hands on the equipment, because equipment was expensive. But I mean, now I think we have some of the best DJs anywhere. I mean, I've, as a manager in later life, I mean, I used to hire a lot of DJs in and out, international guys, and most Maltese DJs could live right up to their standards and better. I mean, I worked a lot with Joy, with Ruby, and people like this that are equally as good as any of the people that we used to bring in.
Miss Roberta.
Yeah. Miss Roberta was a different style as well. But I mean, the whole theme about it was, we used to do these nights at Styx 2, where we would fly in an international DJ, but then we would use Maltese DJs to start and finish. And most of the times we used to use Ruby at that time, who was virtually unknown as the finisher. And it got so good that in the end the people were saying, can't we just have a night with Ruby? We don't need a foreign DJ. Some of these guys are not as good as he is, you know. And I always remember, I don't know if you remember the way that 6-2 was actually built, but it had a massive gantry roof. so that we could get all the equipment from the roof, and you could walk across the gantry, and you could actually walk into a situation there where you could we used to make a secondary DJ box for those things. What we actually said for Ruby was we were going to make a big surprise for him, that he was the DJ for the night, and we would let him down on ropes from harness, and we got the guys with the carabineers there in the mountaineering crew to let him down,
lower
him down with the smoke machine coming up, so people were like, what's happening, who's coming, whatever, and then it was going to be Ruby.
And the legend of Ruby was born, because he got quite a massive following.
Oh yeah, but then we had a bit of fun with him, which was as we got him like about 5 or 6 feet above the DJ area, we started swinging. And we pulled the rope and he was swinging in and out and flailing his arms, you know. And then we dropped him into place. No, I mean, those were the times.
Yeah, you mentioned the Palladium. Could you tell us a few words about the Palladium? Mm-hmm. It was an experiment that didn't work for its original intention.
It was too far ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it had been out probably 5 or 6 years later, when Malta was more organized tourism-wise with regards to getting groups of people into that kind of an environment and so on, it would have been much better. It was just a little bit of a too big a gamble too early. I mean, we used to fill the place, no problems, but I mean, it was a very expensive operation to operate. A lot of staff, a lot of things going on, and a lot of very expensive equipment in there, the big hydraulic rams and everything which used to lift the stage up from the floor, the massive laser system we had, the original Varilite systems that we put in, which were the robot-controlled lighting. All these things were incredibly expensive to operate and maintain.
Could you mention a few VIPs and international stars that you met in your career while you were in Malta?
Well, I think the one that everybody will remember is probably not so much a VIP, but controversial, which would be Peter Powers, the hypnotist.
At
the Palladium, yeah, which, as I said, which we kept bringing back and back and back, because people either believed it or didn't believe it. I was skeptical at the beginning. By the time I'd finished working with him, I'm 110% a believer that the guy has got something about him, and I don't know what it is, but it works. Yeah. For instance, we had a woman who used to bring the tour groups in. As soon as the tour groups were in, we had to make sure she was out of the building before she heard his voice, because she would go catatonic as soon as he spoke.
Incredible.
The things that he would be able to do, as I said, you see him there eating onions, thinking they're apples. And said, no, you do it. All people are just playing it up. Or the two dogs together on stage, doing what dogs do. Nobody would do it. Yes, I mean, because people that were doing it were people I knew. And 100% I would say to them, you know, you're not putting this on or whatever. I don't know what happened to me. You know, I just found myself doing it. And the thing is that the mere fact that they said that, you know, we're conscious that we're doing it, but we just can't seem to stop ourselves, seems to make it even more true. What else? We have Bananarama, Set Me Free, Jackie Graham, who was absolutely brilliant. She was amazing. I mean, that the week that we got her, I had booked her some 6 odd months in advance before that song of Set Me Free had come out, and the week that she was due to come, she was number one in the UK and number three in America with it, and she could charge whatever she wanted just for a public appearance, but she stood to her contract and she came, and my God, what a voice. We were doing a soundtrack. She didn't even need microphones in sticks. Her voice was so powerful, and a true class act, a really nice person. And we had her back again. She came back a second time because she loved Malta. She said, I love the way I was treated here, and it's a beautiful island. And the first time she came, she didn't get a chance to see it, so we brought her back again, and she had a week's holiday here at our expense to make sure she could see Malta.
By my side. just an illusion.
Imagination,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I know you brought them over.
Because we brought them over, well, they were brought over to actually open the sticks to. And I always remember, as I said, I mean, a great act. And going after they finished, we were up in the what was then the VIP cocktail bar, which we made, which was in the old sticks, original sticks, up behind where the old dance floor used to be. And we just all hung out there, and everybody was singing a cappellas and everything till about 5-6 o'clock in the morning and drinking champagne. Fantastic.
Members of Imagination.
Yeah, with Imagination. They were a really nice group of guys.
And were there any VIPs that you just bumped into and said, oh, we're at the door or whatever, and they came in? And
when everybody from Gaddafi's son onwards, who wasn't supposed to be here.
Really?
Yeah, of course.
So international people in politics or whatever. So there would be sort of people who would be going around the Maltese nightlife, and you'd bump into and say, oh, what are you doing here?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I mean, we used to get people that came across that if you were in Malta, there were only so many places that you really wanted to be or had to be at different times. So the big sticks too at that time was the major draw. As you said, at a later stage you had Axis. Mm-hmm. And I, in turn, as you probably know, I was general manager of Axis as well.
Yes, later on.
So, yeah. You know, it all cycled and continued. I mean, probably the biggest people we had there at Axis, people like Brad Pitt and things like this, you know, coming, because we used to do all the after parties, the closure parties, the wrap parties for a lot of the films and so on. So if anything was going on in Malta, then they would be there. So, I mean, all these things, you get to meet people.
When did you decide, okay, Malta's my future, I'm staying here now, this is it, I'm not going to be travelling anymore, I'm not going back to the UK?
Well, at the time, I had a Maltese girlfriend, who later became my wife, and I had done a deal with the De Cesare's that rather than having a regular hire car, which is what I had as my company car, I wanted to buy a decent vehicle. And they said, okay, well, we'll cancel that part of your contract for a lump sum, and you can use that towards buying a car and so on. And I went up through the UK and I got myself a Range Rover, which at the time there was only one other one in Malta, which belonged to the British High Commission. And I came down with this Range Rover and everything. And at that time, up until that time, I'd been keeping certain ties in the UK.
When was this around? Still the 80s, though?
It's in the 80s, yeah. And, I mean, it's before 62, so about 85. I went up and I got this Range Rover and brought it back, and it was like coming back on the boat with it and everything, and thinking, well, I'm here now, I've got my own car, I've got my life settled. I think this is the place I want to stay. I did sell everything up here in Malta at one time. I went back to the UK in the 90s.
Did you?
Uh-huh. In 1992.
So that was around the time when, like, the rise of Euphoria and, like, when the night scene was changing.
Mm-hmm.
What happened there?
Well, because I had two young children. I had my son who was 2 years old, nearly 2.5, and my wife had just given birth to my daughter. And I just somehow thought, well, I've been in Malta a lot, but at the time I thought that for my kids it might be better if they grew up British. And anyway, my wife was as normal, said, okay, give it a try. So I went up and I bought a house in the UK and everything and worked in the UK for a couple of years. But
did you work in the nightlife scene as well in the UK?
No, I didn't actually. In fact, that's when I really gave up the night scene, because with regards to being a DJ, when I went back up to the UK, I took all my record collection, everything with me. And I always remember at the time there was a big thing on for Feed the World and Children in Need, Africa and all this. And I had all these records sitting in my garage doing absolutely nothing. And I thought the only way I'm ever going to cut my ties is to give them up. And I gave them all to charity. Yeah. But unfortunately, I gave away a few valuable records that I wish I'd hung on to, but never mind.
No regrets?
Not really. No, no regrets. I mean, they did somebody else some good. I mean, a lot of the records I had, I'd been given free anyways, promotional copies, whatever. Yes, I mean, obviously, I probably invested thousands of pounds of my money in its time, but that's work in progress and working goods. But at the time, I just gave them all away, but the flight cases, the whole lot.
So you settled down and you had babies. Meanwhile, there were exciting things happening in Malta, though. Clubs were growing, radio stations had opened. You know, you actually were a DJ on Bay Radio for a while. You were the first, one of the first people on that station. And yet you still decided, go to the UK and start a new career. Do you mind if I ask what you did?
Initially, I went over there, not really knowing quite what I was going to do, because I did have an offer for a radio station in Reading to be a presenter. But soon after I got there, that fell through, a bit thanks to the Old Boy Network, one of their, somebody's friends got in instead. So then I started looking around for something I wanted to do, and one thing that had always interested me had been real estate. And I managed to blag myself a job at an estate agency. They were looking for a school leaver type, and I said, well, who would you rather sell to, somebody wet behind the ears or somebody that's mature enough to hold a conversation? And the guy sort of said, yeah, you're right, and he gave me the job. And I worked for a company, Black Horse Agency, which is Lloyds Bank, and I had to go through all the learning procedures of estate agency in the UK, because now over in the UK you have to learn all the statutory rights, you have to learn all the ins and outs of the agency business, and it takes you like about 5 to 6 weeks to get through all the courses and do the exams and everything else before you become. And I was very successful in it. But the major problem I had was coming home. I came home to a Maltese wife that was more down in the dumps almost every day, that she was missing Malta and homesick.
Yeah.
And I thought, happy wife, happier life. It's not going to kill me to come back to Malta. I love Malta anyway.
So when did you come back?
We went over in 92, she came back in 94, I came back at the very beginning of 95. At the end of 94, she came back.
Was there any animosity? Did you leave people upset when you left, or was it all amicable and
what
they understood?
My job?
When you left Malta the first time in 92, it was amicable.
Yeah.
I mean, because obviously you had been working for over 10 years with the same company, so you must have been a valued member of staff, but it was okay. You left on good terms, so you came back, and did you immediately go back into the night scene, but this time...
Well, originally when I came back, I was due to join Frank Salt and be a realtor.
Okay.
But then Kevin came to me and said, whatever they're paying you, forget it, I need you, come back and work for me. And I thought, well, rather than risking commission... because it was commission-only basis here in Malta, and those it still is pretty much in real estate. I was offered a very good wage to come back and work with Kevin.
Alfejn il-lejla fuq 103.7 Campus FM din essenzjali li tesplora l-iżvilupp tad-divertiment, il-qasam tad-divertiment ta' bil-lejl ta' pajjiżna, partikolarment fis-snin 70, 80 u 90, id-diskoteki u stabilimenti oħra tad-divertiment li fetħu u anka għalqu f'dawk iż-żminijiet u ħallew ħafna memorji fost bosta ġenerazzjonijiet ta' Maltin u Għawċin. Inkompli d-diskursata ma' Ian James għax fadallu x'jgħidilna il-ġimgħa diħla f'edizzjoni oħra ta' Alfejn il-lejla. Sadakinar jiena koll il-fejt se nfakkarkom illi tistgħu tisamgħu edizzjonijiet tal-passat ta' Alfejn il-lejla minn fuq is-sit elettroniku ta' Campus FM kif ukoll tinaqdu magħna kemm permezz tal-FM jew DAB jew anka tisamgħu minn fuq is-sit elettroniku biex tisamgħu l-edizzjonijiet li jmiss ta' din is-sensiela. Saħħa.
Bom diggy 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 bong diggy bong. For this.